So it was funny. Last week when Rabbi Greenspan asked me to give the parsha share, I realized when there's a school that my sisters went to, my wife went to, and the whole joke was when I was a kid, every time we asked them, so what did you learn in parsha? They always had something. Well, we went bowling, we did one to 7-Eleven. They never had parsha class. It was to a point even where other people who had boarders or stuff like that had the same feeling about it. So a while back when I was asked one time to substitute there as a teacher and for a parsha class, and I finished teaching and I called my wife and I said, I just gave a parsha class in the school. So it was right. So I'm back here to give another parsha class. And after knowing last week we do parsha and stuff like that. So I was looking through the parsha and I was thinking last week when Rabbi Greenspan asked me to do Pinchas, I was thinking there was, you know, you had the beginning of Pinchas and you had all the karbanos. And I said, why couldn't he have asked me to do something which has a little more excitement, a little more stuff, you know, besides just the karbanos? And then he asked me to do Matos Masi, so I have a double parsha to pick from. So I was going through the parsha, and there were a number of different ideas and thoughts that I wanted to touch upon. Not necessarily all of them are connected, but we'll see some of them will maybe expand upon others. So in the beginning of the parsha, as you were discussing, we talk about this idea that if a woman makes a neder, can it be? How can it be made null and void? So, on the pasuk vav, going in the beginning of the parak, back to pasuk hay. So what happens? Vishama avia es nidra, and her father hears her vow, the esara asher asra al nasha, or the prohibition which she had placed upon herself. Vehecher ishla aviha, and her father remains silent. Vekamu kol nidre vechol isar asher asra al nasha yakum. And they'll establish all the vow or any prohibition which she prohibited upon herself, it will become established, meaning she has to stick with it. In contrast, then, in Pasuk Vav, v'meinia via osa, but if the father restrained her, held her back, for, you know, said he doesn't want it to go through, b'yom shamo es nidareh, on the day that he heard her vow, esareh asher asra anasho, or the prohibition which she had placed upon herself, lo yakum, then it does not become established. And then the pasuk says something very interesting. That Hashem yislach lo, and Hashem will forgive her. Ki ani avi osa, because her father had restrained it from her. So seemingly a very simple understanding would be that even though she made this vow and it doesn't end up staying, because of the form of the vow, Hashem will forgive her for even taking it upon herself to start with. But Rashi says something very interesting, which I want to discuss a little bit. The Rashi says, Hashem yislach lo, and Hashem will forgive her. What's the pasuk referring to? About a woman who made a vow of nazirus. Vishama bala, and her husband hears about this, not her father, her husband. Vahafrala, and he nullifies it. Vihilo yada, but she doesn't know yet that he nullifies it. So she makes this vow that I'm going to become a nazir, therefore drinking of wine, any type of benefit from the grapevine is prohibited, becoming tame is prohibited. And she, right after she makes this vow, but before realizing that her husband had nullified it, she goes and drinks wine and becomes tummy from a dead body. Zohi shetzricha tzlicha. This needs still some form of atonement. The apple peach who moved it, even though it had been nullified, meaning technically she hasn't done anything wrong. She really hasn't broken her vow because the vow had been nullified. But since she didn't know about it, the Torah says, Hashem yislach la, Hashem, she still needs some form of atonement.
I think at that point, isn't it the husband or father hears it, and they say, now they have to know
that they've
broken.
No, they don't know yet. They get reports saying, your wife just made this vow. And the husband says, no, not going to happen. So for whatever, she doesn't know yet that it has been nullified. Because he has a full day. It doesn't have to be instant. I think he has a whole day, 24 hours to nullify. So she decides, this is ridiculous. I'm not having this happen. And she doesn't know about it. And she, meanwhile, went out intentionally and drank some wine, became tummy from a mace, thinking that she was breaking the vow into zeros. But really, she hasn't done anything wrong. And still, the Torah says, V'yislach la Hashem, and Hashem has to atone for her. So then the Rashi finishes off and says, "V'im ha'moivrin tzrichin tzlicha." Now, if one whose vow had been nullified needs atonement, kal v'chomer, how much more so? L'she'enin moivrin, one who did not nullify the vow but intentionally went out and broke the vow.
Those who are not known.
No, okay. I'm sorry. Okay. So, right. So that's what Rashi says. So, on this, there's a Gemara that comes up a couple of times. One in Kedushin at the end of the Masechta on Pei Aleph on Mabez, and then also in Nazir, where I think is the main source of it on Chav Gimel Amid Aleph. And the Gemara says every time Rabbi Akiva used to get to this pasuk, he started to cry. He says, what would happen? He says, if somebody who was intending to eat treif and they give him something which is kosher needs an atonement, how much more so somebody who intended to eat the treif and he actually ended up eating the treif? Which is just an important. So that's the first thing, Rabbi Akiva. That's what Rabbi Akiva used to say. So I saw explained in this is a sefer called Kamotzi Shalom Rav, which is a collection of different Dvar Torah's ideas. Generally, not your run-of-the-mill typical kind of Dvar Torah's and stuff like that. So he quoted an opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Lev Adil, who, based on what I could find, lived in 1865 in Warsaw. At least that's when the time of the sefer that was published. I was able to find the sefer on HebrewBooks.org. If anybody has never used HebrewBooks.org, it's a tremendous resource for Svarim, and they have a great printing that serves to adapt for the Gemara also. So he asked, why specifically did Rabbi Akiva get so emotional about this? There are so many other averas and mitzvahs in the Torah. Why specifically this idea made Rabbi Akiva come to tears? And if, just to put it in contrast, Rabbi Akiva is the one at the end of Gemara Makos that brings down that him and a bunch of other Tanaim were walking in Har HaBayis after the destruction. They see a fox going through on Har HaBayis through the debris. And he starts laughing and singing and dancing. Like, Akiva, the destruction. This is the Beis HaMikdash, Har HaBayis. There's a fax going on. What are you doing? And he says, and he quotes the psukim that says how the fax would be in the times of the destruction, that the faxes and the growth would be on Har HaBayis. And he says, just like that nevuah came to fruition, so too the nevuahs that are talking about the rebuilding will come to fruition. So he was able to see the good and all. So this is Rabbi Akiva, who, within all this destruction of Har HaBayis, he was able to laugh and smile and sing and dance. So what was with this specifically that got him so upset? So Rabbi Yehuda Leib Adol quotes the Zohar HaKadosh, and he says that the Zohar is of the opinion that the Asara Harugei Malchus, which we're going to read about in a few weeks on Tisha B'Av, were really gugolim of the Ten Shvatim, right? That what happened was that there was decreed that the Shvatim were never punished properly for their Chayiv Misa. One who kidnaps somebody is Chayiv Misa, the Torah says. So that they were these leaders of Bnei Israel were Chayiv Misa, seemingly, and therefore that's where they were killed. So with that in mind, it brings down that Rabbi Akiva, who we know had the skin combed off, had the harshest of all the punishments. I don't know per se, but I'm saying that's what they bring down. So why did Rabbi Akiva deserve the harshest of the punishments? So he explains that Rabbi Akiva was the Gilgal of Shimshon. Shimon. Shimon was the instigator, one of the instigators in the sale of Yosef. And what happens, if you go to Parshas Vayigash, so I'm flipping back here a little bit, and when Yosef reveals themselves to the Shvatim, the Shvatim are very nervous, and understandably so. And what does Yosef tell the brothers? He says, I'm not sure if I can find it right away, but he tells them, he says, listen, don't be so nervous. You thought you were sending, you were doing bad, but really it was Hashem causing you to send me down to save us and everything else. And the example he gives, in the Gemara quotes, is the idea that if 10 flames could not extinguish one, and you, the 10 Shvatim, couldn't get destroy me, how in the world is it possible that I, one flame, would be able to destroy and distinguish the 10 of you? So Yosef tells the Shvatim, says, listen, you had intention for bad, but Hashem really had it intended and resulted in a positive. So this is, remember, who was the instigator of all this? Shimon. And according to the Shimon, the Gilgal of that Neshama was Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva, even though the punishment had not been meted out to him yet, the idea that I just saw this in the Gemara Megillah, it's on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph at the bottom, it talks about Daniel, it quotes there, it says Daniel was with his friends, and there's this tremendous, he saw something they didn't see, but yet they had this tremendous fear and they ran away and hid. So he says, the Gemara says that they, meaning Chagai and Ma'achai, were greater than Daniel, and Daniel was greater than them. So his friends were greater than Daniel, that they were Nevi'im and Daniel was not a Navi. But yet, he was greater than them because he saw this sight when they didn't. So the Gemara asks, so if they didn't see anything, why were they running? What were they scared about? So the Gemara explains that even though they didn't see anything, their mazel, their malach that oversees them saw it. And the Gemara says, any time a person has this fear, unexplainable fear, it's that their guardian, in a sense, is seeing something that we're not seeing. So the same idea, Rabbi Akiva, perhaps he wants to, the Rabbi Yehuda Leib Adil wants to explain based on this that Rabbi Akiva had this unknowing idea, that feeling towards this concept, because Shimon really was this idea. Shimon intended to do harm to Yosef, and yet Hashem caused it for good. And still we see from this idea of this neder of a nazir that still he needed an extra atonement. A person still needs an atonement, even though they were thinking they were doing something wrong, and they ended up not doing anything wrong. Shimon thought he was doing something wrong, but yet it resulted in a positive thing. So Rabbi Akiva had this this fear, this connection to this concept because of that. That was it. Yes?
Reuven intercepted him and said, no.
So,
let's not. He circumvented Shimon carrying out what he wanted. He stopped it.
He stopped it to a degree, though.
His intent was to then take Yosef out and return.
Correct.
But he knew he couldn't allow that blood to be.
So, right. But meaning, so Reuven prevented it to a degree, but Shimon still, Shimon and Levi,
he was the
right, and he and his intention
was, yes.
And if you go through over there, what was their intention, what was Yehuda and Reuven's argument back to Shimon and Levi and the rest of the brothers in terms of what are we trying to accomplish? Are we just trying to accomplish that his dreams don't come to fruition? Or is he really Chayav Misa because he's considered a Rodev? He's trying to separate us from getting the brachos like, you know, we had with Yaakov and Esav and Yitzhak and Yishmael. So you're right that Reuven prevented the bloodshed itself, but nonetheless, Shimon still was the instigator. His intention was still to cause harm to Yosef. Maybe not to kill him, but to cause him harm. And Yosef, but the end result was that the harm was Shimon's intent.
But he's going to harm him, but he doesn't see it that way. I mean, obviously he wouldn't be doing, he sees it as he's doing the right thing. Obviously, Yosef is Chayav Misa, so he doesn't, but how do we reconcile that and say that he's, you know, he thinks he's doing wrong?
So what you can say from that is, even though perhaps in Shimon's mind he was correct in his mind, and the truth is the rest of the Shvatim also had in some mindset, Reuven brings it up later. He says, you know, this is all happening because of what we did. We didn't consider the languages. We didn't consider enough our father's feelings, which was really there, meaning really Al-Pidin, maybe Yosef was Chayav Misa, or something should have happened. But if you take the whole picture and see what the effect would have been to Yaakov, that should have prevented them from doing it. Nonetheless, though, we'd have to say that they were definitely received from the history, the way it plays out. And Mefarshim explained that the Asari Harivi Malchus were a result of the sale of Yosef. They still kidnapped him. That there was still something they were chayiv for. So their intent was still to cause harm to Yosef for right reasons, wrong reasons. Yosef, they were clearly scared of what Yosef was going to do. That's clear. And Yosef says, you have nothing to worry about. It was all Bidei HaShemayim. It was all from Hashem's Hashem's guidance. If I can find the exact pasuk here, I could... here.
Right,
here it is. It's in Perek Mem Hei, right there, and it starts by pasuk Dalid. Vayomer Yosef el Echov. Yosef says to his brothers, Geshu no elai v'yigashu, come close to me if you please. And they came. Vayomer ani Yosef, achichem, I am Yosef, your brother, Hashem v'chartem osi Mitzrayim, which you have sold me to Mitzrayim. V'yato, and now, al tiatzvu, right? He says you should not be distressed. V'ayichar be'enayem, it should not be angry in your eyes. Ki mechartem osi heina, because the sale of me, behold, ki l'michya shalachani Elohim l'vneichem, because for life Hashem sent me before you. So he's clearly saying, you're really innocent on this. It was Hashem's doing, but I mean that was a concern of the Shvatim when they came.
I guess it's hard to understand because, you know, if they truly are a Bezdin, I mean, if they truly are what they're supposed to be doing, then by putting him to death, then they did, then he gets a kapora. In other words, they're only doing good. Obviously, later on, I mean, now they see they made a mistake. But even Joseph's statement, you meant it for harm. You meant harm. You meant to do something that would be negative towards me, but obviously if they're on the level there, we learned they're perfect tzaddikim, then they didn't do anything wrong. Maybe they should have, but they can't consult their father because he's biased. You know,
they were also biased.
So
the understanding of Shvatim and the whole Seil Yosef is a difficult thing to understand in general. Often what we find is, even by Shimshon and others, which are tzaddikim, that there's something that they aren't even realizing within themselves that are causing, that for anybody else it would be like nothing, but for them on their level they should have had that deeper and more reflective understanding. They didn't even realize it was there until afterwards, and it was really we all have it at some level in ourselves. We do things and we think that we're doing it for one reason, but if one would really have true reflection, they'd understand that there was probably another driving force pushing us ahead. I know as a kid when I was I wasn't feeling well, so I'd say tell my dad, he was a psychiatrist at that point in time when I was that age. He says I'm not feeling well. You know, he says it's up to you. It was the worst thing because I felt guilty then, like. If he said don't go to school, said I felt fine, clear conscience, you know, I probably could have gotten to school, whatever. But once he says, it's up to you, so really I'm not feeling great. But maybe I could push myself. It's a hard reflection to truly understand on oneself.
Well, maybe you can answer here that the issue is they shouldn't have been his judges. They were not only brothers, they were biased by seeing a schid. The sin becomes that they shouldn't have been judging him in the first place.
Right. It's
the question is how much sinus is it, and how much is it like the sinus kingdom is like? Is it really sincere? From our perspective, it is. But if they're really truly tzaddikim, then they're going to consider the evidence. But
it's like I said, the whole understanding any of the incidents of anybody in Tanakh are always a very difficult thing. I always explain to the students when I used to teach Shmuel Aleph, and we learned about Shaul. So one looks at Shaul, he's this jealous, crazy king going around killing people, you know, trying to chase David around and everything like that. And I said, you have it all wrong. I said, if one has to look at Shaul and understand, first of all, we start off, talks about Shaul looking for his father's donkeys. I said, how old do you think Shaul was at this point in time? The way he start off, he sounds like he's 18 years old or something. His father sent him out to find the lost donkeys. Well, he becomes melech right afterwards. He's melech for 2 years, and he's old enough to have children that are getting married, that are generals of the army. My guess, I don't know if it says exactly, he had to be at least close to 40 years old at that point in time. And we're told that he never sinned, it's brought down, he never sinned before he became melech, and then he sinned twice as a melech, and both times, which we'll actually discuss a little bit, I think, today, was his sins came from a lack of gaiva, almost. He was such an anov that as an individual, that was fine. But he didn't have the respect in the sense of realizing his position as a Melech Yisrael, that he had to take charge and take command. So those were his two mistakes. But yet, what happens is, throughout even this chase with David, who was a Mori B'Malchus in the sense, he was the next in line to become king, and he was anointed as king. Shmuel was nervous to anoint David even, and Hashem tells him, well, take some animals, you'll bring him as a carbon, so if somebody asks you, that's what you're doing. So even Shmuel was nervous about all this. But Shaul at one point in time even has David cornered. He's within striking distance. And word comes that the Plishtim are attacking. And Shaul drops what he's doing. His goal was to get David. He drops everything. And he goes to fight the Plishtim. Right after Shaul loses the Malchus, he's told, he still is going out constantly to fight for Bnei Yisrael. So he understood his priorities were to fight for Bnei Yisrael. In the beginning, he was rejected from by Bnei Yisrael. And yet, he goes out and fights for Bnei Yisrael. And to the point, so this idea that he got upset at David, it was a depression. But it was a depression for the right reasons. Shaul's entire purpose and goal in life was to get as close to Hashem as possible. And he achieved that. When he became a melech, he had this tremendous level of nevuah. And as soon as he lost the malchus, that level of closeness that he had with Hashem shrank away. And there was that he had it. He had something that is a goal for everybody to get as close to Hashem as possible. And then he lost it. And that's what caused that depression. And then, through Doeg, who was giving him bad advice and kind of putting seeds down against David, but he saw this closeness and this hatzlacha that David was having, and every time he saw that closeness that David had, that's when the jealousy rose up. And we see every time that David was played for him and kind of got him in a better mindset, when one can be come closer to Hashem, or even when Shaul goes himself to capture David and he goes to Shmuel and suddenly he has the nevuah, he's fine. I mean, he can be brought out, but because Shaul's depression was for the right reason. So anybody says Shaul was a rasha or he was crazy, they don't understand Shaul. Right, and he didn't wait for Shmuel to bring the karbanos when fighting.
What about the 24,000?
That was, but he was they were chayav misa.
What did they do?
They helped it, David.
Yeah, I see.
And it was again, it was also in a state of depression. But there, and the truth is, he's a complete shua for that. We see later on that when he tries to find out if he should go to battle or not, and he ends up speaking to the sorceress to bring up back Shmuel, he says a number of different things that he attempted to do without response, but he doesn't mention the Choshen. He doesn't mention the Rav Tumim because he was embarrassed because he realized he didn't have it in the set because of what he had done to Novi Rakohanim. So, again, to understand any of the people in Tanakh in the level that we is very difficult to understand. You have to understand who they were and take that and try to put that in that light. There's a concept my wife and me were discussing recently, the halacha of Danis Chavir Lekaskos, to judge someone favorably. And I was explaining that people understand it as a general, I always had to judge somebody favorably. I said, it's really not so true. There are many times we do, but often the situations we come to are more of a midah than it is a halacha sometimes. And if one would think about it, when we have these opportunities, it's not that we're really judging them in a favorable light. If we take a step back and reflect on the situation, we realize that out of all the options that make sense, usually one of the more favorable ones, all right, I tell the kids, I said, if you came home and you saw one of your parents sitting on the couch eating some candy or something like that and relaxing, and the house is a mess, and there's nothing, you know, nothing's ready, cooked for dinner, everything, what would you think? You think your parents just being lazy and doesn't want to do anything? Or that maybe the washing machine broke and they're having a bad day and you're not feeling well? Most people realize that that's not the reality of the parent. The parent's usually doing a lot and they don't want the house to look like that. And something else happens. So it isn't that I'm trying to figure out a solution to say how it's a positive. But if one is able to step back and reflect on it, they realize that makes the most sense. And the Gemara brings down a story, ends up with Rabbi Akiva. I think it was right before Yom Kippur. He was working and he said, okay, I have to go home now. Can I have my wages? And the person says, I have no money. So do you have animals? He says, I have no animals. I have cushions and pillows. I don't have that. And he goes on and on, and Kiva leaves. Afterwards, after Sukkot, he comes with carts and wagons full of delicacies and food and money to Rabbi Kiva, and he says, every time I said each thing, what were you thinking? So he says, well, I thought maybe your money was tied up in something else. I thought you made this hektish. And he explains each one. And he says, he gives them the kids, says exactly what it was. If one realizes, so Rabbi Kiva went to all extremes to figure out solutions of how to put him in a positive light. And the truth is, if one thinks about it, we're talking about a Tana, we're talking about Yom Kippur. He's not somebody who's just going to lie and rip some and try stealing. These are the most logical situations that you might have to think a little bit, but if you want to put in their true perspective, realize who these individuals are, we're not talking about somebody who is already caught for stealing and robbery and drugs. We're talking about the leaders of B'nai Yisrael. They're not going to go out just to cheat somebody on a dollar or two. So that's a little bit about about Hashem Yisrach Lo. Yes.
Well, there's still a difficulty in this Rashi when he, like you're saying, because the minute this woman's husband was made for her as a nulli, her neder nizirus, it's as if the neder did not exist. So she's not doing any kind of an aveira at all.
Correct.
Not committing any kind of maisa is incorrect. So, but apparently, according to Rashi, she has some kind of a guilty mind, or she has the wrong kind of intention, because she thinks that she doesn't know that it's been annulled, so she thinks that she is over on a neder, so she has the wrong kind of mindset, the Rashi is implying that she needs a shlichus for that.
So that's going to bring me my next point then. So it's an intent she had. She didn't do anything. So what's the problem? So years ago when I was in Silver Spring, a lot of stories from Silver Spring, I was giving a model lesson, and the person for Chumash class, and the principal, the headmaster says to me, says, Parshas Noso. I'm like, Parshas Noso, it's crazy. It's a monstrous Parsha. So I was thinking, what in the world am I going to teach about Parshas Noso? So I got to the class, and I brought in a tzedakah box and a roll of pennies. And I told the kids, I said, take a penny and put it in the tzedakah box. And the kids went around, they did that. And I told them, I just want you to write on a piece of paper what you were thinking when you gave the tzedakah. And the kids did that. And then I start going through Parshas Noso. And I explained, there are over 80 psukim of repetition. The same exact carbon. Why? The Torah doesn't waste a letter, we're told. How in the, why does the Torah need to repeat over and over and over the exact same carbon? Just say, all the Nesiim or these Shvatim brought this carbon. And I explained to them, one of the common themes over there is that even though each Shevet, each Nasi brought the exact same physical carbon, their intentions were extremely different. When they brought each item, they had different thoughts, different kavanas, to the point that it was considered a totally different carbon that Hashem needed to record each one separately. So the kids, what are they? That's nice in theory, but really, is that how we do it? So I gave him an example, one which does not work as well nowadays, but at that time it did. He said, imagine Saddam Hussein pulls somebody out of the street in the middle of the night, drags him to his torture chamber, and without any medications, takes a saw, chops off the guy's leg, throws him back out on the street. And the person's family was waiting outside, quickly grab him, bring him to the hospital. The doctor looks at him and says, you know, you're very lucky. The guy's not feeling very lucky. He says, you had a certain type of blood clot that if your leg would not have been amputated when it was, you would have died. Fine. Similar story. You go to the somebody goes to the doctor, and the doctor is checking the individual out. And the doctor says, we have to do emergency surgery right now. No time for medications or anything. Puts him on the operating table, takes a saw, has to amputate the leg. Same exact procedure. Same reasons in the sense of the person having the type of blood clot. What would you call what Saddam Hussein did? It's torture. What would you describe what the doctor did? He saved him. Even though both did the exact same actions, their kavana was extremely different, and therefore it was we consider it a different action. To the point even the Rambam brings down in Hilchos Shabbos, that if a person intended to pick one fruit but ended up picking a different fruit, he's not held accountable in the same way if he would have picked that fruit that he intended. A person intended to kill one person and killed somebody else, it's a different law. Meaning one's intent does change the way we rule on the action. So I went back around and asked kids, what was your intent when you put the penny in the tzedakah box? And I had some very creative answers from different kids. But the idea is that a person's intent, even though we generally don't say if a person is thinking about an avera, we consider it as an avera, which is a question on this in general, but a person's intent does change the action that occurred. So to the point that we see the Nesiim, each one had to be recorded separately.
It's fascinating what you're saying, because I think of that like when Hashem told Avramir to be dedicated, if he asked that to Esav, Esav said, oh, I'll do it right away. And then Esav can say, Esav killed Nimrod, you know,
right.
But he's Chayamisa. Why? Because he was, his intent was to kill somebody. He wasn't trying to get rid of Nimrod for the judgment. So
right. And we discussed last week also by Shimon and Levi when they killed out the city of Shechem. Yaakov tells them, according to one opinion, this wasn't the Kvodiyah, wasn't the Shem Shemayim. Yet Pinchas comes and he kills Zimri, the Nasi of one of the Nesiim, and we say that was the Shem Shemayim. He gets Bracha, Shalom, and Kuhun, and everything. So we see that intention does change what the situation is. So that was one idea I wanted to bring out there. Another just interesting question later in the Parsha, when we're talking about the division of the land, taking the land, we start listing the different Shvatim that had. And just quickly see if I can find it. And when we go through it, it starts off with Yehuda, and it talks about Shimon and Binyamin, and it lists their Nasi. And then it talks about the other Shvatim, and it does, and there it uses the language of Nasi. Just quickly see if I can find where it talks about it. So, yes, okay. It's in Parshas Maaseh, in Perek Lamed Dalid, in Pasuk Tes Vav, it all begins. It says, Elish Mos Aneshima Sheinchalu Lachem Es Aretz, these are the names of the men which will they are cost to inherit for you the land, Elazar HaKohen V'Yeshua Ben Nun. V'Nasi Echa, Nasi Echa Mimata, and each Nasi for each Shevet, Tikhu, they will take Lincho Es Aretz to inherit the land. The Elish Shemos Hanashim, these are the names of the men. Lamati Yehuda, for the tribe Yehuda, Kali ben Yefuna. Lamati ben Shimon, Shmuel ben Amihud. Lamati ben Yamin, Elidah ben Kislon. So we see there the language is the tribe, and then the name of the Shevet, and then the individual's name. Then it says, Ulamatin of Don, and for the tribe of Don, Nasi Buki ben Yogli, Livne Yosli, Ulamate ben Eben Asha, Nasi Chaniel ben Ephod. And it continues on each time using the word Nasi. So the obvious question is, why by the first three, by Yehuda, Shimon, and Binyamin, it doesn't mention the word Nasi, and the remaining six, it does mention the word Nasi. On top of that, the order of these of the listing of the Nasim doesn't seem to follow any pattern we've had in the past. It doesn't go by age order. It doesn't even go by the way they used to encamp. Binyamin was on the west. Yehuda and Shimon were on the east. So what's the order? So I saw, again, brought down something very interesting based on the Gemara Nedarim on Mem Dalet Amud Aleph. It starts on the Mishnah. And it says, one who makes a neder that they're not going to let somebody get benefit from them of any of their possessions. So the problem was that in the cities, you had public roads that belonged to, everybody had a portion of it. So if I prohibited through a neder from somebody getting any benefit from my thing, from my possessions, they wouldn't be able to take, to use any of the public facilities, anything which belonged to the public. So the Mishnah gives a suggestion. It says, what they should do is you write off your portions to the Nasi, so that then it will become the Nasi's, and therefore the public roads would belong to the Nasi, and somebody else, the other person, would be allowed to use it. And Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah says, however, those of the Galil don't need to do this because they used to always quarrel, and their forefathers saw this, and therefore they automatically wrote their things, those public parts, off to the Nasi. That's the Mishnah and the Gemara in Nedarim. So how does that play a role over here? So he explains there are Eretz Yisrael, and this we split up into three portions. We have Evrayam, so the portions east of the Yarden, which we have Reuven and Gad and part of Menashe. You have the southern part, which was Yehuda's portion, where you have Yehuda, Binyamin, and Shimon. And then you have the northern part, and the Galil, which was the other six Shvatim. So if you look now carefully at the Pesukim, which I just thought it was pretty impressive, the three Shvatim that does not mention Nasi was from the area of Yehuda, Yehuda, Binyamin, and Shimon. The six that we mentioned the word Nasi were the people from the Galil. So he wants to bring down here that perhaps this was a hint to the idea that those people of the Galil, the other areas, were going to give off their portions, their rights, to the Nasi. It was the Nasis, actually, those public parts, because the nature of them to fight and to make such neders against each other. So in order to prevent such problems of using the public thoroughfares and such, they would give it over to the Nasim. Again, I just thought it was a different type of answer for this. I saw another answer brought down that Yehuda and Binyamin both had the portions of the Beis HaMikdash in their land, so therefore we don't mention Nasi, and Shimon really didn't have it. He was part of Yehuda, so he doesn't mention there. But again, I just thought this was a different perspective, and it's an interesting connection to the Mishnah. Okay. We'll finish off with one more idea here, and we'll connect it to an earlier Parsha. If you go to Perek Lamed Aleph, the beginning of the Parsha, near the beginning of the Parsha, so it says that Hashem tells Moshe, Vayidabera Hashem el Moshe le'mor, Hashem speaks to Moshe, saying, Nekom nikmas b'nei Yisrael me'eis ha'midyanim, that b'nei Yisrael should take revenge from upon the Midyanim, Acher Tiyasef Elamecha, after they have gathered onto your people, meaning since they caused the Bnei Israel this death. And then what does Moshe say? Vayidaber Moshe el ha'am le'mor, Moshe speaks to the nation, saying, Hechal tzumirchem anashim atzava, arm from amongst yourselves, people, the legions, v'yu al Midyan l'seis nikmas Hashem b'Midyan, and they will be against Midyan to give revenge for Hashem against Midyan. So Hashem says to Moshe, gather Bnei Israel, take revenge for what they did to you. Hashem tells Bnei Israel, gather together, we're going to fight because what Midyan caused to Hashem. What's going on here? And on top of that, Rashi, in Pasuk Beis, says as follows. I'm sorry. In Pasuk Gimel. Vayidaber Moshe, Moshe spoke, Afo pishe shama shemisaso tuluyi bedavar, also besimcha v'lo ichar. Even though we're going to see later in the Pesukim that Moshe heard that his death is dependent upon the completion of the battle with Midian, nonetheless, he did it with simcha without delay. Moshe, we're told, says, and after this battle, that's going to be kind of the end. Then you're done your job, and you're gonna pass away. So what happens? Hashem says, listen, Moshe, I can, and this is brought down in the name of the Kli Yakar. He says, I can forgive what Midian did against me. But for Bnei Yisrael, that I can't forgive. That you should take revenge for the deaths that they caused by Bnei Yisrael sinning, all those deaths of 24,000, that you have to revenge. So Moshe was afraid. Moshe said, if I tell Bnei Yisrael that after we go to battle, and it's for our kavod, I'm going to die, they might not want to go fight. So they, Moshe will be mochel on our kavod. We don't need to. If it's for you to live longer, we'll be mochel. So Moshe says, no, it's for Hashem's kavod. That we can't be mochel on. And therefore, there will be no delay in us going to battle, and there's nothing we can do about it. There's an interesting idea that I saw brought down earlier by Eldon and Meidad. Earlier we find, right before Parsha Shlach in Baloscha, it was a famous question, why does Yeshua get the bracha before Moshe sends them to spy out Eretz Yisrael? And there are many different answers given, but this answer I thought was very unique and fit very nicely into Pesukim. In the previous Parsha of Baloscha, we see that Eldon and Meidad were continuing to prophesy, and we're told that a lad comes running to Moshe and tells them, Eldon and Meidad are having a nevuah, and Rashi says, what was the nevuah? That Moshe was going to die and Yeshua was going to bring us into Eretz Yisrael. And Yeshua tells Moshe, Moshe, you got to put an end to them. We can't have this. And Moshe says, don't be so zealous for me. Halavai, all Bnei Yisrael should be nevi'im. So what happened? Moshe saw that Yeshua's love from him, Yeshua's love for Moshe was so great that he would want others to be punished if they said anything negative about Moshe. So Moshe knew that he, based on this, knew that as soon as they go into Israel, Moshe was not going to be living or he would not be leading in Israel. He was afraid that Yeshua, out of his love for Moshe, was going to go to Israel and convince the other Meraglim that Israel wasn't good and come back and give a negative evil report in order that Moshe could live longer. So Moshe goes and gives Yeshua this extra bracha so that he would not be influenced by his great love for Moshe to speak negatively against Eretz Yisrael.
Wow.
And here we see this idea that Moshe also displays. He's like, I don't want Bnei Yisrael to take this love for me and do something which we shouldn't be doing. So we'll stop there, and in about 5 minutes we'll convene again for a little bit more.